Sisters in Texas, brothers in Texas, today we commemorate and reflect on 100 years of women voters, and we do it on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rant Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown, voting by mail and some challenges facing Texans. How the Army helps Texans fight against COVID-19, and one scientist who's painting a more accurate picture of the past and future spread of the virus. Is it possible to have it all at 15, including a book deal, a Texas story that is sweeter than honey? And we lay a virtual wreath at the feet of the graves of the suffragettes. Wear a white dress. This is the Texas Standard. It is the centennial of the 19th on the 18th. You are tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Today is Tuesday, August 18th, and it marks the centennial of the 19th Amendment, 100 years of some women getting the right to vote. Joy Diaz would not have been able to vote 100 years ago, not because of my birthright. I am an American, but because the love stories that gave birth to me were not 100% white. It would take several more decades before all women, particularly women of color, were able to exercise their right to vote. And we'll spend some more time marking this historic anniversary later in the broadcast. But now, we lay a virtual wreath at the feet of the women who made the right to vote for other women possible. We also lay a wreath on the path of those women who continued the fight, because the path to the voting booth has not been without obstacles. One of the tools used to exercise the right to vote for all Americans is facing challenges in recent days: the United States Postal Service. Some would argue that is a new obstacle for voters this November. A letter from the U.S. Postal Service was sent out this week to several states, including Texas Secretary of State Ruth Hughes. And for more on that letter, we turn to James Barragan. He's a State House reporter for the Dallas Morning News, where he's been writing about this story. James, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hey, Joy. Good to be here.
James, what does the letter say exactly?
Yeah, so basically, the Postal Service is warning the state of Texas that because some of its deadlines for mail ballots, they are creating a quote-unquote mismatch, which creates a risk that ballots requested near the deadline under our state law will not be returned by mail in time to be counted for the November elections. So a little bit of a risky situation here if you're trying to vote by mail, which we know many more people are interested in doing.
And is the risk that the ballots would not be tallied? Is that the risk, or is the risk that they would just not make it in time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. There are some that would not make it in time and therefore would not be counted. So yes, the risk is considerable, and that is that the Postal Service is sort of trying to warn Texas election officials about, so that they might be set in motion some rules or some guidance for voters trying to vote by mail to make sure that they are turning their mail ballots in with ample time to make it to their elections officials by November 3rd, by Election Day.
I know that last night during the Democratic National Convention, the speakers were saying, request your mail-in ballot today. I mean, we are in August. Are we seriously asking voters to request their mail-in ballots today and to mail them today? What is the deadline for Texans?
Yeah, so that's part of the question that the Postal Service is bringing up here. The deadline, you can request a mail ballot up to 11 days before the election. You'll start receiving them at the earliest, I think, 45 days before the election. But you can request it now, yes. So all those speakers, you know, I was watching it too, and that struck me as well. I mean, they are really trying to make a concerted effort to make sure that everybody gets their applications in. Because the application is one thing, but getting your mail ballot is a different thing. And then you've got to send the mail ballot back, which is part of what the Postal Service was talking about in this letter. There's so much that goes into this process, right? So they are encouraging everybody to request them early. Once you get your ballot in the mail, get it done and turn it in early so that you can check with your elections officials to make sure that they have received your ballot before Election Day.
James, does this letter have anything to do with the changes implemented by the Postmaster General?
So that is a great question. And the U.S. House of Representatives, there's a select committee that is actually going to begin an inquiry into this. Democrats believe that President Trump's administration is trying to make cuts to the Postal Service or changes to the service that will impact vote by mail. Because he himself has said, in his own plain words, has said, if they don't have the funding, then they can't deliver the ballots by mail. So it seems from the president's comments that this is influenced by his desire to impact the vote by mail turnout, and the congressional committee will be looking into it. So we will have answers on that soon. But if you look at just the president's comments, I think it's pretty clear that there is an impact here from what his desires are.
So if we were to be specific and sort of create a listicle about what folks in Texas need to know about voting by mail, what would you tell them about deadline, process, website, phone number, whatever you think is important for voters to know comes to voting by mail?
Yeah, so I would echo what officials are saying, which is to apply early, apply now.
Okay.
I would also advise them to check with their local elections office, to call their local elections office, just to get a primer on how to actually vote by mail once you do get it. Because what happens as well is that a lot of ballots get rejected because there's a missing signature, or the signatures don't match up, or it's not received on time. The best advice is to call your local elections office and say, hey, how do I do this correctly? Because I want to make sure that my vote counts. And they should be able to walk you through every single step. There's a little secret envelope that you've got to put inside another envelope. And then there's certain days that you've got to send it ahead of time to make sure that it's there. So my best advice is apply early, talk to your local elections officials to make sure that you are doing it right.
James Barragan is a State House reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Joy.
About 600 military medical personnel have been deployed around Texas to help hospitals keep up with the demand for bed space, staff, and supplies. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame paid a visit to San Antonio's Baptist Medical Center to see how an Army team works to fight against COVID-19.
Heart check for D room 450.
Army nurse Mika Carafi has developed an almost bat-like sense of hearing since she arrived at Baptist Medical Center in July. She works in a COVID ICU, where different machines sound alarms almost constantly.
So you get attuned to, oh, that's a feeding pump. Whose feeding pump is going off? And then you're like, oh, that's an IV pump. Okay, where is that? And so you walk around the unit looking to see whose pump is going off so that you can make sure.
Carafi is one of 23 Army medical personnel deployed to Baptist to help the hospital cope with coronavirus patients who flooded in after Memorial Day. The 32-year-old lives in a nearby hotel and works 12-hour shifts.
Before we even came in, we had heard that the nurses were taking 4 ICU patients, which is a lot. Normally, ICU nurses take 1 to 2 patients.
We basically knew from our command team that it was a hot zone.
That's Shadia Leal, who's also on the Army team here. She's a preventive medicine specialist who was deployed to Iraq and Seattle during that city's COVID crisis. Part of her job is making sure medical staff around Baptist have proper PPE and that they're following protocol when it comes to infection control.
On one of my first days here, I was able to go into the COVID unit, and you can see a little bit of the fear in the patient's eye because COVID is just such a scary disease.
When the team got to San Antonio, they found the hospital stretched thin, its layout and staff having shifted to accommodate COVID patients at different stages of the disease. Connie Thigpen is Baptist's ICU director, and she remembers when the Army arrived.
It was a collective sigh of relief. They have aided so much in not only the physical load, but the mental load, the emotional load just by sharing in that need to care for these patients in this COVID population.
Army ICU nurses have taken on 20 shifts a week, sometimes caring for 3 to 4 COVID patients at a time. The Army also sent 2 internal medicine doctors, an infectious disease specialist, and a pulmonary critical care physician, along with other medical staff. Their presence has enabled Baptist to nearly double its ICU capacity, from 30 beds to 56. And they're helping prevent burnout, which the hospital's chief medical officer, Lynette Watkins, says is a big issue.
Particularly with a pandemic that is going to continue to go on for a while. So in addition to being able to expand staffed beds, the influx of our colleagues also affords our physicians, nurses, and ancillary support staff a bit of rest and downtime.
Code blue and 809 canceled.
That's always a good thing.
COVID admissions to Baptist are down since the Army team showed up, but the hospital is still nearly full with COVID and non-COVID patients. ICU head nurse Connie Thigpen is anticipating the worst.
Because I think that we're far from being over. We may be in somewhat of a lull statewide right now, but I certainly hope people don't see that and gain a false sense of security from that, because we have so many other challenging things coming up with reopening of school, flu season, so many unknowns.
Despite that, the Army's deployment to Baptist could end as early as September, according to one hospital official. The Army wasn't able to confirm that. Army Captain and ICU nurse Mika Karafi, who's never been to a combat zone, says working in a civilian hospital has caused her to adjust her expectations for her military career.
We'd always heard about supporting the civilian missions, but it just wasn't very prevalent. And we talk about that frequently within our group, that like things are changing with how we're deployed.
Karafi says she's ready to fulfill her mission, no matter what it looks like or where it takes her.
It's just a different battlefield for the day, you know?
I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
That sound tells us it's time to welcome Wells Dunbar. He's our social media editor. Wells, what are you hearing from social media platforms?
Hi, Joy. Well, we're continuing to hear about the story at the top of the show, the slowdown at the Postal Service, and Texans' fears their ballots may not be counted come November. On our Facebook page, Jonna Blackley picks up on one aspect of the controversy we heard about the president's opposition to voting by mail and its impact on the Postal Service's woes. Jonna writes, "Given the president's comments about withholding relief funding for the Postal Service, I'm curious to know why nobody seems to be accusing him of abuse of power, or is that no longer a crime?" Just one of the comments we're seeing out there today, Joy. Plenty more reaction out there online about day one of the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah.
Be back with some reactions about that and more. Yeah, later in the program.
I like that. Find us on Facebook. Tweet at us, or find Texas Standard on your social platform of choice.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Across Texas, the COVID-19 crisis is not nearly as dire as it was in July. Hospitalizations and the number of positive cases appear to be falling, but so is the number of people getting tested. And health officials are still concerned we could see another spike. Houston Public Media's Matt Harab talked with local health leaders on how likely the city can keep numbers down in August, especially as schools reopen.
At the beginning of June, Dr. David Peirce with the city's health department predicted Houston would confront a surge in coronavirus infections by July.
And looking at these graphs, we've got a linear growth right now. It's pretty steady growth. I wish these numbers were flatter than they are.
But as Dr. Peirce feared, the numbers went even higher. On some days, new COVID cases were double what they'd been just 1 week earlier. To Peirce, it looked like the momentum was building.
If we don't have a second wave, I will be very happily surprised.
For 17 total days in July, Peirce's department reported at least 800 cases, which forced hospitals to activate their surge plans. Then, beginning earlier this month, cases per day began to drop. The Houston Health Department reported under 500 new positive cases last Monday through Friday. Harris County hospitals collectively reported under 500 COVID patients in their ICUs for three of those days as well. Dr. Umair Shah, Harris County's public health leader, doesn't want people to let their guard down, though.
I even want to catch myself in saying that numbers in the hospital system are looking better, because the moment I say that, I feel like the natural inclination is to say, oh, I don't have to wear my mask anymore.
Or go get a test. The percentage of people testing positive has dropped significantly in recent weeks, but the Houston Health Department says the number of people seeking one is a third of what it once was. Dr. Shah says the county is seeing similar problems.
Maybe people think that if I get tested once, that means that I'm somehow immune to the virus. The test is a treatment.
The irony behind the drop in testing is that there's no better time to get one. Dr. Shah says it only takes a couple of days to get results. And Dr. Peirce says testing is critical now as schools prepare to reopen classrooms.
My prediction for the fall is that either we're going to do really well or we're going to do really poorly.
That's because he and other health officials don't know how COVID-19 will interact with other viruses in the fall.
The influenza virus, the respiratory syncytial virus. So we could have people with COVID who are coughing and they just, oh, it's just the cold, and therefore not take precautions. The COVID virus would then spread even more than it is now.
Which is why Dr. Shah says it's important to remember there is still no vaccine. So wearing masks and staying socially distant are the only ways to drive down the community spread.
There are a lot of things that are in the road ahead that really are very much about a marathon. You run it 1 mile at a time. This next several weeks is another important mile in this long-term race.
The city is reporting 189 COVID-19 deaths already in August. I'm Matt Harrib in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Michaela Ulmer is one of the youngest, if not the youngest, authors published by Penguin Random House. She's a Texan. She is 15, and her new book is called Be Fearless, B as in bzz, dream like a kid. It's a part memoir, part business guide. Michaela Ulmer is also the founder and CEO of Me and the Bees Lemonade. Michaela, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. I'm very surprised. I mean, yeah. It's unbelievable that I'm writing a memoir when I'm 15.
Right? But I want to hear all about how Penguin Random House approached you. How did this come about?
So let me start with the lemonades. For those of you who may not have heard my last interview here, I have a lemonade company, and I started as a lemonade stand when I was 4. And so I traveled teaching about social entrepreneurship and also about the bees. The bees are important pollinators, and they're also dying at an alarming rate. And so they helped me grow my lemonade stand.
Let's connect the bees and the lemonade. Your lemonade is sweetened with honey, right?
Yes. So it's sweetened with honey. There's 5 flavors. There's mint, prickly pear, half enough iced tea lemonade, ginger, and classic. And each of those flavors are inspired by my great granny Helen's 1940s flaxseed lemonade recipe. So that's a huge part of the story, was like this old tattered cookbook that had a recipe, and I decided, hey, I just learned about the bees. What if I sweeten it with honey instead?
Yeah.
And so unfortunately, due to being a student as well, I'm in my junior year of high school, mm-hmm. I can't accept all those events. So one of the hardest parts is having to decline and not like be able to share my story. And so I think the reason why we started was because I realized this book could be a way for me to reach a bigger audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, why not? Even though it's a little harder to release the book, people can still learn and learn about social entrepreneurship.
So your story, just as the book says, it's a kid's dream, but the grown-ups followed. And to me, it's such a lesson for grown-ups. Tell me a little bit about how your parents got on board with this.
Yes. So my parents both were a little shocked when I said that I wanted to figure out how to get my lemonade in stores. But when Eastside Pies in Austin said, hey, if you can find a way to bottle your product, I'll carry it. Neither of them had experience in the beverage industry. But my mom had her own marketing firm. She was an entrepreneur. Mm. And my dad worked finance at Dell. So they both taught me what they know, like how to give, save, and spend, how to make a budget. And my mom taught me marketing, some public speaking, and she also had the idea of putting me in a bee suit when I was selling at the lemonade stand.
Michaela, what are your top three business secrets?
One thing that I've learned is that you should always ask for help when you need it. In 2016, we changed the name from Bee Suite Lemonade to Me and the Bees. It was another company who had a name similar to ours. They said either pay us like a couple million dollars or change the name. And as a 10-year-old, I didn't have a couple million dollars to borrow a name. And so we just started asking for help, seeing who could give us expertise, whether it was in the law industry or branding and rebranding the business. It was an experience that was hard and a turning point for the business, but also a really big lesson that I learned. Another one is that it's not just the product you sell, but the story you tell. Like the power of storytelling when it comes to business and how you empathize with your consumer, whoever your customer is. I think that's so important. And then the last one I'd say is dream like a kid when it comes to business. When I started the company, all I saw was I want to figure out how I can save the bees. And that's how I dreamed of my business. And so think of like your end goal or why you started instead of first thinking about all the obstacles. That's what I like to call dreaming like a kid.
One thing that I wanted to ask you is about books for young Black girls. Who are the heroes or the heroines that you would like to see on books today?
Well, I really look up to Madam C.J. Walker, Marcy Martin, Skye Jackson, Marley Diaz, and those are all like Black girls who are activists or kind of pioneering their field, and she, I think, is amazing. One girl that I just mentioned, Marley, has a whole collection called 1,000 Black Girl Books, and it's all about those stories, which is pretty cool.
Michaela Ulmer is the founder and CEO of Me and the Bees Lemonade, and now also the author of Be Fearless, Dream Like a Kid. Michaela, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Tonight's Democratic National Convention keynote address will spotlight 17 of the party's rising stars. That includes Dallas Congressman Colin Allred, who says Texas is the biggest battleground state in the country.
And what we're trying to talk about is why Joe Biden also has such a unique appeal here in Texas and the direction that we think we can go in as a country and as Texans.
Dallas State Representative Victoria Niave is also part of the keynote. A new survey suggests most Texas Latinos prefer to vote in person in November. KUT's Ashley Lopez has more on the results of the Latino Decisions poll.
Pollsters asked Latino voters if they preferred voting in person or by mail if both were an option in their state. 57% of Texas Latino voters specifically said they preferred voting in person. Only 43% said they preferred voting by mail, even though there is widespread support nationwide for mail-in voting. Janet Murguia with Unidos US, which commissioned the poll, says vote by mail has not been as commonly used in places like Texas, where it's limited to voters who are over 65 or disabled.
Our community needs to hear from trusted voices what the facts are about voting early, voting by mail, and making sure that if they do vote on Election Day, the best and safest way to do that.
The poll also found that 76% of Texas Latinos say they are concerned or very concerned that they might be exposed to the coronavirus if they vote in person. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Days after the Austin City Council approved major funding cuts to its police department, Houston's mayor says his city's decision to increase the police budget in June reflects his feelings about calls to defund law enforcement. But Sylvester Turner said yesterday there's still a need for police reforms.
You can always do things better and more efficiently,
And we're seeking to do that.
Later today, the Texas governor is announcing a proposal related to police funding. And the U.S. Energy Department is planning to send several gallons of radioactive water from a site in South Carolina to a West Texas facility for treatment and disposal. Cyrus Reed with the Sierra Club's Lone Star chapter explains the DOE has reinterpreted federal rules to classify the water as non-high-level radioactive waste.
Initially, they've only authorized a small shipment of only 8 gallons, but that is to test it because there are 10,000 gallons of this wastewater in the Savannah River site.
The DOE approved the move earlier this month. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the online UT High School, offering a full-time diploma program and a variety of individual courses, including for advanced placement. Learn more about options for the new school year at highschool.utexas.edu.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The early spread of COVID-19 before March, when lockdown orders were issued by states across the country, appears to have been far greater than initially thought. A new paper out from a group of researchers at the University of Texas in Austin indicates that thousands of people with undiagnosed flu symptoms actually had COVID-19 last winter. Here to tell us more about this research is Lauren Ansel Myers. She's a professor of integrative biology and statistics and data sciences, and she leads the UT Austin COVID-19 modeling consortium. Professor Ansel Myers, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So what does this recent research reveal about just how widespread COVID-19 was before we went on lockdown?
So this study focused on two different cities, Wuhan, China, and Seattle, Washington. And what we did was we tried to go back and connect the dots to try to figure out in those early weeks of transmission how many people were actually infected. And what we found in both of these cities is that most cases, thousands of cases of COVID, went completely unseen in those first few weeks. So in Wuhan, we found that by January 23rd, which was the date that China locked down Wuhan so people couldn't travel in and out, that by that date, there were probably over 12,000 cases, people who had already been infected, already had symptoms, but were never diagnosed with COVID. Wow. And that compares to only 425 cases that were actually reported. And the other thing that the data tell us about Wuhan is that it probably started spreading in mid-November, you know, months before we became aware of it in the United States.
And what about Seattle?
So in Seattle, we looked at a slightly later period of time. We were looking at how many cases were there up through early March, specifically through about March 9th. And by March 9th, just to give you context, Seattle had only reported 245 cases. And based on our analysis, we believe that there were probably closer to 9,000 cases during that February, early March period. And that the virus probably started spreading throughout Seattle in early January, possibly even in late December.
Professor, why those two cities?
So we focused on these two cities because we had an unusual source of data available. There were actually two studies that preceded ours that did something very interesting. They went back and they found swabs that had been taken from people with flu-like symptoms, and they retested them for COVID. And what they found in Wuhan was that of about 26 adults, there were 4 undiagnosed cases of COVID. And in Seattle, they retested about 2,000 swabs, and they found 25 undiagnosed cases of SARS-CoV-2. And so that data allowed us to do the following kind of calculation. We were able to say, okay, for every case of flu in the city, how many cases were there of COVID? And in Wuhan, what we found was that for every 3 cases of flu, there were probably 2 undiagnosed cases of COVID. And in Seattle, what we found that was for every, well, in adults, for every 7 cases of diagnosed flu, there was probably 1 case of unseen COVID. And in children, for every 9 cases of diagnosed flu, there was probably 1 case of undiagnosed COVID. the dates and the numbers are very specific for the cities that we studied, for Seattle and Wuhan. But when we look at data closer to home, when we've looked at data from Austin, Texas, the trends that we saw in March and April suggest that it was probably spreading locally as early as mid-February before, you know, weeks before we began to really detect the cases.
So it was because we didn't have much COVID testing. Is that the reason why these cases went undetected, you think?
Well, there are a few reasons. I mean, one is, you know, this was a period of time when we were just getting to know COVID, learn the properties of this virus, ramp up testing. So it was just an early period where we didn't have a lot of knowledge and we didn't have a lot of infrastructure to track the virus. But the other reason is that just in general, we know that this virus is really stealthy. It spreads really quickly from person to person, and it often spreads silently. People who develop symptoms are often spreading the disease for a couple days before they ever have symptoms. And possibly as many as 40 or 50% of all people who are infected never even know they have the virus because they never develop symptoms.
Professor, so what does all this mean going forward?
It's really a reminder of how quickly this spreads, how silently this spreads. And as we move into fall and kids start returning to schools and college kids start returning to campuses, it's just a reminder that we can have a lot of transmission, a lot of cases before we actually see evidence of an outbreak.
We've been speaking with Lauren Ansel Myers. She's a professor of integrative biology and statistics and data sciences, and she leads the UT Austin COVID-19 Modeling Consortium. Professor Ansel Myers, thank you so much for being here again.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
Yo soy Daria Vera.
My name is Daria Vera.
Yo nací aquí en Rio Grande City, Texas.
I was born in Rio Grande City, Texas. I am a third-generation Texan, but I don't speak English. My mother didn't speak English either. No one here did, except my brother, because he was in the military.
Mi hermano, el único que hablaba inglés fue uno, el mayor que fue al ejército. Yo, en 1966...
In 1966, I started protesting my working conditions as a farm laborer. I used to pick cotton, cantaloupes, green beans. The ranchers here used to pay us between 40 and 50 cents per hour.
La agua no la traían de los canales. Los canales, ahí habían sapos muertos.
Working conditions were horrible. The water they gave us was from the canal. It had always had dead animals, dead frogs, snakes. There were no bathrooms. We used to go in the fields, men, women, it didn't matter, in the fields squatting.
Pasaba el avión envenenando el algodón.
A small airplane would fly over us while we were working the fields, spraying pesticides.
Ellos no tenían pendiente de nosotros que nos cayera ese veneno.
They didn't care about us. So in 1966, some people came from California and we went on strike. When ranchers started busing in workers from across the border in Mexico to replace us, we blocked the border bridge in Roma, Texas, with our bodies. We linked arms and sat on the asphalt. The Texas Rangers came, beat up the men, and arrested them. They thought that would do it. So I told the women, we should continue blocking the bridge.
Puras mujeres bloquear el puente. Me dijeron, no, tenemos miedo.
But the women were scared.
Yo no tenía miedo.
I was not scared.
Le dije a la otra compañera, le dije, pues, ¿sabes qué?
I told a girl from California I was going to lay down and block the bridge. She did the same, and the two of us stopped traffic. I remember a big truck was about to cross into the U.S., and the guards at the border were telling him to just drive over us.
Yo lo que pensaba era que si el muchacho nos pasaba por arriba y nos mataba, pues ni modo, pero nos iba a matar.
And I thought, if I die right now, At least I died fighting for our rights. But we changed things for farm workers. That's why I'm very proud of women. We make things happen.
Yo sé que nosotros las mujeres hacemos los cambios en la sociedad.
When women got the right to vote, we made things better for others.
Pues ahí me siento un poco triste porque digo yo, esto de nosotros es historia, digo.
The only thing that saddens me is that our names are not in the history books. It's been over 50 years.
The fearless life of Daria Vera ended August 6th. She was recorded in 2019 as part of the Standards Project that honored the centennial of the passage of the 19th Amendment. The project is called 100 Years, Voices of Women Voters. Months before her death, Daria Vera's name was finally inscribed on a historical marker. Daria, we salute you. The graves of the suffragettes at the Oakwood Cemetery in Austin recently inspired Jennifer Chenoweth to highlight their achievements and share them with the general public. Jennifer Chenoweth is Museum Site Coordinator at the Oakwood Cemetery Chapel, part of the Parks and Recreation Department for the City of Austin. Jennifer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
I would love for you to talk about how what you do is something that you can combine with this centennial.
So one of the things that fascinates me about the Oakwood Cemetery is that it had all the original founders of Austin and a lot of Texas leaders as well buried there. And so it is my privilege to contemplate the meaning of life in the context of lives lived and people who are buried there. And I do that in themes. So we create an online exhibition that talks about the themes that unite these people. So our summer exhibition is called To Vote, and it is an investigation of the people who worked for suffrage who are buried at Oakwood Cemetery and other City of Austin municipal cemeteries.
Two of the things that I really enjoyed about your exhibit. One is that it's digital, so even during a pandemic, people anywhere can visit it and explore it. And the other thing is that you are in Austin, but you took it to a whole different level. You extended it statewide and even international. Please tell me a little bit about some of these women.
The first burials in our cemetery started in 1839, which in the context of the history of the world is not very long ago. Many were born in Europe. Many came from the American South, some came from the American North. The Tejanos were already there. The native people were being forced to leave. And so our history isn't just Austinites. We knew that Dr. Annie Webb Blanton and Jane McCallum were buried there. But then we did some digging. It was really quite an exciting investigation in which I basically write a interactive digital book that's published on our website, that's in about 18 chapters. There's a introduction, a history of suffrage, a history of women of color's path to suffrage, and then a profile of 14 different individuals who really, really spent hundreds to thousands of hours working to achieve the right to vote.
You have women like Maud Sampson, for instance, and one of the things that you do in the exhibit is that you sort of put dots on the maps, on the Texas map, where she lived, where she worked, so we can trace the history and sort of be a fly on this wall that you created that tells a story.
Indeed. Maud Sampson was born Maud Craig, and her father ran a grocery stand. She was interested in an education, and one of the choices was Prairie View A&M.
Because Maud was Black.
Yes, Maud was Black, and her choices for education would be Prairie View A&M, Samuel Houston College, or Tillotson Normal Institute at the time. And mm-hmm. She, like a lot of young people, might have wanted to get out of town for college. So she went to Prairie View A&M University and then ended up with a job in El Paso as a teacher. It was harder to track her in the records at the time because white people's documentation and records were a lot more accurate and thorough than people of color. Why she is so important is that she was one of the people who corresponded to the national women's suffrage movement to try and join and to get her women's club in El Paso to be part of that membership, and was denied that simply because they were black and there was intense racial discrimination between the groups.
And beyond the racial diversity, you also brought the international diversity. And you talk about Helen Kirby. You talk about Anna Walker. Can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Anna Walker is somebody I would love to have dinner with. She came from France originally, and her family lived in other parts of America in different states before they ended up settling in Texas. And she had voted in other states, and she wrote lots of articles in Dallas newspapers. She just wasn't afraid. And I would like to know what that was like in that time.
Jennifer Chenoweth is the creator of the exhibit To Vote. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to widespread feelings of social isolation, anxiety, depression. To help cope, some people are turning to cannabis products. Recreational marijuana sales in Colorado hit a record high in May, and a budding hemp industry in Texas is attracting new customers. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports.
In Bergheim, Texas, just north of San Antonio, there's a skunky smell in the air.
You know, that's a really good description. So skunky is a very typical terpene that is in most of these plants.
Austin Ruppel is president and co-owner of Pure ISO Labs, a company that grows and sells hemp and CBD, or cannabidiol, products.
You're looking at permitted hemp in the state of Texas.
He stands next to rows and rows of more than 300 plants.
So the cherry bubblegum will have a kind of a sugary, kind of a tart smell to it.
Hemp is a type of cannabis that's rich in CBD, a legal compound that does not get users high. It contains much less THC, the psychoactive component that does get you high, which is still illegal in Texas. Congress legalized hemp federally in 2018, and Texas followed suit last year. Now, this farm and others are preparing for the first ever legal cannabis harvest since the plant was banned statewide nearly a century ago.
Hello!
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
The little shop next to the farm is full of CBD products. Co-owner Jennifer Ruppel shows me the product line.
We have topicals, beverage additives. We also have your typical oils or tinctures.
Ruppel says demand for these products has crept up since the COVID-19 pandemic began. But why? She chooses her words carefully.
So you get just an enhanced benefit, let's say, from it. So
she's cautious because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has only recognized CBD for certain uses, like treatment of epilepsy. But when Ruppel says enhanced benefit, well, what are the benefits? Can CBD, as many claim, actually help with anxiety?
Yeah, so it's definitely still up in the air. And I think it's, you know, obviously people are theorizing that CBD might be helpful for anxiety, but there's not really any good data yet, any high-quality data.
Kent Hutchison is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. He and his colleagues are working on a long-term observational study on how CBD and THC affect anxiety. But an observational study won't generate as high-quality data as a clinical trial would.
If we were to do an actual clinical trial, it becomes much, much more difficult given the regulatory hurdles that we have to deal with.
Regulatory hurdles pop up because cannabis is still a Schedule I drug at the federal level, the most regulated category for high-risk drugs with no medical use. That status goes back to the culture wars of the Nixon administration.
It is essential for the American people to be alerted to this danger, to recognize.
So we have a very Janus-faced relationship with CBD and with cannabis in general when it comes to mental health issues and what the therapeutic possibilities could be and what the cultural baggage still is around this.
Martin A. Lee is the author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana. And he's the founder of Project CBD, a nonprofit that promotes cannabis science and therapeutics.
For centuries, humankind has had a connection with the plant, but because of marijuana prohibition, we lost that connection, and we're in the process of relearning that today.
In Texas, the process of relearning is happening slowly. This first crop of hemp will be smaller than many expected, and in late July, growers received more bad news when the state announced a ban on smokable hemp. So while the pandemic may have increased demand for CBD products, it's unclear if hemp farmers in Texas will be able to meet it. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in the Texas Hill Country.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Well, Dunbar, how are you? He is our
great
social media editor.
I'm doing great, Joy.
Good,
every
good
day is a great day with you, you know,
it
Joy.
It is. I am the joy of
exactly
y'all's life.
It's true. Reactions. So many reactions out there online about day one of the Democratic National Convention playing out on a screen near you. Yes, here's what some of the Texas Standard fan base out there has to say about it from our Facebook page. Ihor Galda called it strong across the board. Kasich and Bernie, John Kasich, Bernie Sanders, were on point, and Michelle Obama stuck the landing, referring there to her closing, speech of the convention there last night. Nicole LeBlanc says, I honestly felt the speeches and moments with regular people had more impact without all the typical attendant visual hoopla
they
and
were
distractions.
Good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely did vary things up. I saw some of it. I missed the live broadcast, but I caught the play-by-play on Twitter, as I am wont to do. Janice Hitchcock has a contrary opinion. She says, it reminded me of a charity telethon. They did a great job highlighting that many intelligent, articulate people understand that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. But in her opinion, they did nothing to change the fact that Joe Biden is unfit for office and incapable of making it through a basic interview.
A lot of opinions there, yeah.
Mm-hmm, definitely so. And Marcus Sengupta says, my thoughts, this is our alternate choice. So let's find a third party. So obviously, yes, a range of opinions out there.
Yeah,
well,
not
represented by
happy
our
with the choices,
no,
of course.
No. And so who knows who we'll be happy with tonight as well. We've got who do we have here? We've got Jill Biden, the nominee's wife, going to be speaking there. Bill Clinton, kind of an interesting choice that Bill Clinton is going to be featured there because controversies and in the year
for
2020.
For so many reasons, yes.
Yes, and speaking of controversies, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, there was all that pushback at the 60 seconds that was previously allotted to her pre-taped convention speech. So whether or not that remains the case remains to be seen, but we'll be watching closely and keeping an eye on that.
I know yesterday you and I were talking about, there's not going to be enough Texans in there. And
right,
it was just
fast forward
they threw
to last
them
night
all.
Yeah, several featured there at
Eva
the beginning.
Eva Longoria opening, Leon Bridges, Filemon Vela, Lina Hidalgo, Art Acevedo, Beto O'Rourke. The family of, the name escaped me. I'm so sorry, Wells. But
no worries.
Anyway.
Yeah, but definitely on the night of a big night of Texas representation there. And going to be continued, as we heard in the roundup, we're going to see people including state representative or U.S. representative Colin Allred as part of the suite of new leaders. Well, speaking of leaders, I should mention, work in another mention here of that fabulous series that you really helped conceptualize there. Joy, that
it
100
baby,
years
yeah.
It certainly was 100 years voices of women voters, and just an incredible collection of women's stories, the impact that this historic 19th Amendment has had on them. And you can go to texasstandard.org/100years,
that's right,
to check all those out, and some wonderful photos and some really powerful audio from women on basically what the vote has meant to them and how it has really impacted their lives. So I would encourage folks one more time to go check that out at texasstandard.org/100years.
On behalf of all the women and all the men who make the Texas Standard, thank you for listening. David Brown is back tomorrow. I'm Joy Diaz.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to providing clear and scientifically vetted information about COVID-19. Texas A&M articles and reports about this global pandemic are available at fearlessfront.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.